Hello, and welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Jason Harris. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, we spoke with Craig Souter, MD, Director of Cleveland Clinic's Blood and Marrow Transplant Program, and Brian T. Hill, MD, PhD, Director of the Lymphoid Malignancies Program, and a staff physician at the Cleveland Clinic Taussig Cancer Institute, about the use of CAR T-cell therapy in patients with lymphomas. Dr. Souter and Hill discussed the findings from the Phase 3 ZUMA-7 and TRANSFORM trials, which suggest that CAR T-cells might be more effective in the second-line setting compared with standard treatment. They also considered the potential for allogeneic CAR T-cells, new data showing that investigators may be able to cut CAR T development time down to 1 to 2 days, and ways to expand access and address financial toxicity.
How does CAR T therapy fit into the sequencing for follicular lymphoma and NHL?
For follicular lymphoma, as the audience is probably well aware, we do have very good standard treatments with chemoimmunotherapy, either bendamustine rituximab or R-CHOP are frequently used as initial treatment. The disease has a variable course, and some patients have relatively early relapses, whereas we expect remissions to typically last many years. Some patients don't respond or relapse within, let's say, 12 or 24 months after completion of treatment. And in that setting, we know that patients have poor outcomes, and therapy like CAR T is very effective and offers potential for excellent disease control and probably durable disease control. In that setting is where I think that it has the greatest role.
I'm sure you've seen the results from ZUMA-7 and TRANSFORM, which suggest that CAR T may be more effective than standard treatment following initial chemotherapy, but the Belinda trial says there's no difference. So what do we do with those results? How do you then decide how to sequence these agents?
Large B-cell lymphoma is the most common non-Hodgkin lymphoma. And again, we do have very good outcomes with our CHOP chemotherapy. But when patients relapse or are refractory to treatment, particularly within the first year, historically, outcomes with subsequent chemotherapy followed by autologous stem cell transplant has been sort of the standard of care.
The intention, as Brian introduced, of these three studies was really to test CAR-modified T cells in the second line for relapsed or refractory diffuse large B-cell lymphoma patients that historically were approached with a standard of care that included platinum-containing salvage chemotherapy followed by transplantation. So these three studies were all similar in terms of one-to-one random assignment in relapsed or refractory large B-cell lymphoma with the intention to define a higher risk patient population as either primary refractory or early relapse within 12 months of end of induction therapy. All of them were one-to-one randomization between their experimental CAR-modified T-cell product in that setting versus the standard of care of platinum-containing chemotherapy followed by high-dose chemotherapy and autologous transplant in patients that achieve a remission. There were key differences between all three studies. The similarity was the patient population as well as the primary endpoint of event-free survival, which by and large was defined as either change of lymphoma therapy, progression of the lymphoma, or death from any cause. The TRANSFORM and ZUMA-7 studies were reported positive towards the primary endpoint. The Belinda study, which studied T-cell-gen like Lucel versus standard of care, was a negative study. There were key differences between the three studies, including the disallowing of bridging therapy on ZUMA-7. So it was intended to really study CAR-modified T-cells versus the standard approach. And the other two studies, TRANSFORM, which is lysocabtagene maraleucel versus standard of care, allowed bridging, as well as the Belinda study, T-cell-gen like Lucel versus standard of care. The Belinda study was negative towards event-free survival versus standard of care for potentially many reasons, one of which is highlighted was the prolonged time from enrollment, apheresis, and CAR-modified T-cell infusion in the experimental arm, which was greater than 7 weeks at a median compared to or in contrast to Zuma 7 and Transform, which were each within 3 to 4 weeks. So again, Zuma 7 and Transform were positive studies towards the primary event-free survival endpoint. The majority of subjects on all of these studies were primary refractory disease, meaning not achieving a complete metabolic remission to R-CHOP-like induction therapy. So I believe it's still a conversation whether or not to pursue platinum-containing salvage chemotherapy in a patient with relapsed disease, with some consideration to time to relapse, as early relapse patients were allowed on the three studies. But demonstration of previous chemotherapy sensitivity, I think, should be taken into consideration when making decisions about sequencing these therapies. But clearly, the FDA found the data convincing to allow approval in the second line for primary refractory and early relapse cases for both axicabtagene ciloleucel based on the Zuma 7 study, as well as lisocabtagene maraleucel based on the TRANSFORM study.
Considering the differences in these trials, is it fair to link them all together and then generalize about the use of CAR-T in second line?
I think that you can generalize from the TRANSFORM and Zuma 7 studies. They really do show that moving directly to CAR-T in second line is better, quote unquote, than second line platinum-containing chemotherapy followed by a transplant. But they didn't really address the question as to what would happen if you randomize patients who are responding to second line therapy and randomize them to receive CAR-T or high-dose chemotherapy with autologous stem cell rescue. So that's a little bit of an unknown, but for really refractory cases, we know that the likelihood of responding to second line chemotherapy is generally pretty low, especially in primary refractory diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. So I would say it really has become the standard approach to use axi-cel or lisocabtagene in those highly refractory or early relapse cases.
Is that how you approach it in your clinical practice?
By and large, yes. And Brian and I work closely together at the same institution with these patients between the lymphoma program and the blood and marrow transplant program, which also delivers CAR-modified T-cell products. I could speak for Brian that we have paused in a patient that achieves a complete response and has relapsed disease, depending on the kinetics of the relapse, as well as the biology of the tumor. But I fully support what Brian says in a rational sense that a patient that doesn't respond to anthracycline-containing combination chemoimmunotherapy is unlikely to respond in the salvage setting to more cytotoxic chemotherapy, and data from prospective studies have borne that out. A primary refractory patient has less than a 20% chance of being cured with a standard platinum-containing salvage chemotherapy followed by transplant, those that respond. And I would like to highlight that the clinical question that he brought up is that we really don't know in a responding patient. There are a lot of logistics around getting patients to CAR-modified T-cell therapy. So in a platinum-containing salvage responsive patient, we don't know that question of whether or not pursuit of the standard of care is still warranted as opposed to CAR T-cell therapy in that setting, with the caveat that we know through a multitude of both prospective and retrospective analyses that tumor burden is highly prognostic for patients proceeding to CAR-modified T-cell therapy. So that could also be an advantageous setting for a patient that's having cytoreduction prior to CAR T-cells. I personally believe it's still an open question, but clearly primary refractory patients are patients with very early relapse disease, which we would by and large consider refractory, are indicated for the two FDA-approved CAR-modified T-cell products of axi-cel or lisocabtagene.
Now, Dr. Sutter, you touched on one of the known drawbacks to CAR T-cells in that there's a lack of access for patients. Only about 25% of eligible patients will get CAR T-cell therapy. So what are some of the efforts that you're keeping an eye on to expand access to allogeneic CAR T therapies?
I've always been sort of evangelist to highlight these study designs that are by modified intention to treat. In the CAR-modified T-cell arms, often it was the patients or the subjects that get the CAR-modified T-cell therapy are analyzed for efficacy outcomes. But if you really look at patients intended to go to CAR-modified T-cell therapy, with a fallout, I would advocate that those patients or subjects in studies should be placed in the denominator. So that rightfully speaks towards the rationale of having a product, quote unquote, off the shelf that's readily accessible like any other pharmaceutical agent. As a purist, I would say it's open for study because there are biologic concerns that a non-autologous product lacks efficacy in relation to persistence and potential immunologic rejection from the host. So the studies are ongoing. We've been encouraged by some response rates on studies, but they're limited in terms of number of patients as well as follow-up. So anxiously awaiting those long-term data.
Allogeneic CAR T therapy is a sort of emerging technology that uses an off-the-shelf approach of a sort of universal donor. So a healthy donor may have their T cells collected and modified and expanded. It does require additional genetic modification, particularly editing out of the T cell receptor gene locus to minimize the potential for basically graft versus host phenomenon. It is under active investigation, but is not, I don't think, ready for widespread use or regulatory approval. But the idea that you may be able to treat a patient with a cellular therapy in a community or smaller setting by taking allogeneic off-the-shelf CAR T cell or other cell product and delivering it is very attractive, provided that the toxicity profile is favorable and the infrastructure for the cell handling still can exist in a smaller hospital setting.
Now, for autologous cells, we've seen some results lately suggesting that the process can be sped up. There's Penn has just produced preclinical results showing that they have a process where it takes just 24 hours to produce CAR T cells. Novartis is evaluating YTB323 that says it can also go about 2 days to the final product. So I don't know if you've seen these results and what your take on them is. You know, we're going from about 14 days to a fraction of that. So that's great news, but you know, is it real?
Yeah, I think we need to see more data. The data I've seen is highly encouraging, but like many things, until we see it done on a larger scale, I think it's a little premature to conclude that that's going to be a viable approach, but it looks exciting.
I would like to add to that, it still requires an autologous apheresis of the patient, and those variables can play into time to treatment, including being able to procure apheresis slots, having a central venous catheter placed, et cetera, that are independent of the manufacturing time. That being said, those data are exciting. The approaches are exciting. Certainly, if you were to cut down manufacturing by 50%+, that could be a win with equal efficacy in vein.
Is that the kind of thing that would really radically reshape the use of CAR T cells?
It may, but I agree with the idea that it would still not be something that would be easily done in the community setting because of the infrastructure requirements. So exciting and could speed things up, but I don't think it would solve the problem that we still have of getting this out to smaller hospitals and community settings.
I agree with Brian. I don't think it would radically transform things because data have suggested that less than half of the patients that are indicated for CAR T-cell therapies aren't able to get to the centers and be treated. And that's not just in rural areas. That could be in densely populated urban environments as well. So it's not just rapid manufacturing. There are other variables at play.
There are about 120 centers right now that can offer CAR T-cell therapy. How do you expand that number? How do you get the technology to the community and to more patients?
That's a great question, how to get this available to more patients. One idea I've heard discussed is to have sort of Red Crosses or apheresis centers or sort of central collection areas where a patient might be able to go regionally to have their leukapheresis product collected and sort of dispersed across wide geographic areas. But ultimately, it still is going to require a certain level of expertise and a critical volume of patients at smaller community hospitals to feel comfortable managing the toxicities, cytokine release syndrome, and neurotoxicity. These can be difficult to manage and can require intensive care unit stays. So until you have a minimum experience and infrastructure, I think it's going to be a little tricky.
I agree with Brian. It would require a critical mass and a willingness to staff or to train not just licensed independent practitioner staff, but personnel from the ground up to be able to handle these logistics. And in places where the case density is not that high, developing that expertise can be somewhat prohibitive.
So like all things, it comes back to money and time, really.
And resource, time,
yeah,
effort,
and
resource.
Yeah, and patient volumes.
And volume and substrate, correct.
One of the other stumbling blocks with CAR-T is just the expense. And obviously, allogeneic CAR-T cells will hopefully cost less than autologous, but how do you address the financial toxicity associated with these treatments?
It's a real issue, and I think we've struggled with that as a society at large, not just our professional societies. Ultimately, that gets distilled, putting a price on patient quality adjusted life as measured by years. And there have been random figures that have been determined to be meaningful versus non-meaningful. I clearly do not have expertise in this matter. Financial toxicity is real. And I believe that it will eventually come to a position where how much is our state sponsorship or governments able to sponsor patients that don't have resources like robust insurance and are in need of these therapies. It's going to come to a head with some of the emerging gene therapies in historic populations that do not have great socioeconomic access to healthcare. So it will be something that we'll have to continue to deal with as a society. But I clearly do not have the solutions.
You know, ultimately having, you know, the ability for Medicare to negotiate drug prices may be the starting point here, because right now there's, you know, no restrictions on what, you know, insurance and Medicare has to pay whatever is set to be the price by the manufacturer. And until that can be negotiated, I don't think we're going to be able to move the needle on this.
Because that difference places strain on the individual institutions. And this takes away, again, time and effort from other pursuits like developing better therapies and being able to take better care of patients.
We're coming up on the end of our time, but I want to give you both an opportunity to talk about some future-looking things, some projects that are coming up that you're excited about. Is it CAR T cells beyond CD19? Is it armored CAR T cells? What are you looking forward to seeing reported in the next few years?
Despite the tremendous advance in CAR T therapy, if you take diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, we still are only really curing about half of the patients who undergo this treatment. So that means about half don't enter durable remission. Clearly, CD19 loss can play a role in those recurrences, maybe in 25 to 30% of cases, but that still leaves the majority of failure to respond to be due to other causes. So ongoing work to determine genetic determinants of that in the tumor, as well as in the cell product, are ongoing. More approaches to target different antigens, so the antigen loss can't lead to tumor escape, is an exciting area. And certainly the off-the-shelf option may get around the problem of T-cell fitness, which is frequently impacted by prior therapy for the disease.
I would support a lot of those thoughts. I do believe that if off-the-shelf therapy were equally efficacious, particularly for patients that actually got product infused, that could be a win. I think there's a lot of concern that it's an allogeneic product and rejection from the host, lack of persistence and potential lack of durable remissions would be a concern. So we do need to see those follow-up data. Frequently in academic talks around CAR-modified T cells, there's a slide where an iceberg is shown as the tip of the iceberg. And I do believe that. We know very little about T cell, specific T cell selection or phenotype in manufacturing of the product or selection of phenotypes. The lymphodepletion platforms have not been rigorously studied or exhausted, or the study being exhausted. and looking at ways to adjunctively incorporate other pharmacologic agents to potentiate the effect of the cellular therapy and potentially modify the tumor microenvironment, I think are all avenues that require exploration. Maybe not just making a better CAR T cell, but looking at all the other environmental factors that go into the efficacy of these products. Because again, to echo Brian, you know, when you tell a patient in clinic that you're actually more likely to have at some point disease progression with this therapy, there is a sense of shock because of all the excitement within the media sphere and the community about the proof of principle with this therapy, but we still have a long way to go.
Dr. Sauter, Dr. Hill, thank you so much today for taking the time out of your busy schedules. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
That's all we have time for today. Thanks again to my guests, Dr. Craig Sauter and Dr. Brian T. Hill, and thank you for listening to this episode of Onc Live On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates on oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. Onc Live is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at Onc Live and at Onc Live SOSS. On Facebook, like us at Onc Live and Onc Live State of the Science Summit, and follow our Onc Live page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of Onc Live On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to Onc Live On Air.